Oi, you. It's time for another episode of Dorothy and the Dealer. Let's tune into the conversation.
Let me tell you, I know the words. I've sung it thousands of times.
Go on, sing it, Eamon.
What am I singing? Well, I've been walking these streets so long, singing the same old song. I know every crack in these dirty sidewalks of Broadway.
Keep going.
Well, hustle's the name of the game, and nice guys get washed away like the snow and the rain. Oh, yeah. There's been a load of compromising on the road to my horizon. But I'm gonna be where the lights are shining on me. And like a rhinestone cowboy.
That's one of the things that I remember a lot from you is going to a Christmas at the Beans and you and the Carols with the guitar singing Rhinestone Cowboy. It's one of the things I remember.
So
from saying that you weren't going to sing anything, you did an amazing job. That was so good.
Hey, that's why he said it.
I was hoping I was going to be asked. You know?
No, did you not see him at the YouTube video and he was listening to songs on the YouTube?
Dean Martin is my favourite, you know.
Oh, I love Dean Martin.
Do you know Dean Martin, 1987 actually, in New York, in London.
Yes.
Yeah. London Palladium.
Did you go to see him?
The show, no I didn't, but I have the show on every day. I play all the songs every day. It's absolutely fantastic.
Do you remember me taking you to Neil Diamond?
Oh yeah, I've been there. Neil Diamond was great, wasn't it?
Numerous times.
Oh yeah.
I think I took you twice.
Neil Diamond.
You saw him here with me. I was with you, me and
Hank. Oh, jeez, yeah, I do, yeah, yeah.
The drummer.
The drummer,
like this huge big black guy. Remember, massive. And then I think his violinist was a woman, remember?
She was
He was standing at the top of the stage, and that was turning round.
And
then the band was on the
going the other way. Yeah, very, very good.
That's so good.
Very, very good.
So speaking of that, right? So,
can I just say that just officially to welcome to Dorothy and the Dealer, Eamon. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
We wanted to make sure we perfected the show before we got you on. Do you know what I mean? Because we knew you were going to be trouble. So a couple of things. First off, it is an honour to have you on here, Eamon, and I speak very fondly of both my parents throughout my whole career, and have done throughout my whole career. Well, the reason I have you here is because we want to put you on the spot with some stuff. Yeah, okay.
Just don't ask me my bank account details. You're not getting them until I go.
That's fine. So I just want to, I think we should probably start back in the beginning. So can you just tell everybody, first off, where you were born and what life was a little bit like as a young lad when you were born and brought into the world? I mean,
yeah, talk to us about it.
What was your childhood like as a kid? You know, where were you born? Where were you raised? What was it like?
Well, I was born in Dublin. I was born in Hollis Street Hospital, and anybody, any Irish person will actually know where Hollis Street Hospital is. And my first memory of really anything was the day my mother brought me by the hand into school in St Andrew's School on Pier Street. Yeah. And when I went there, I had a green Gansey and a green pair of shorts.
What's a Gansey?
A Gansey was a jumper, jumper with three buttons at the top and sleeves on it.
Yeah.
And the sleeves at that time, on reflection, was very important because everybody had a snotty nose. And everybody used a sleeve as a handkerchief, and you'd wipe your thing. And no matter who you'd meet, you'd always have this big streak on the end of your sleeves. And that's the way life was. But I remember going in, and the teacher was called Mrs. O'Riordan, and I can even see the situation now. And when she put me in the desk, I peed my pants. I was so nervous.
Really?
And she was about 6'6" to me at that time, because it was only a small little thing. But school times.
So did you have to sit in the pee the whole day?
I had to sit in the pee the whole day because I couldn't tell anybody. And she brought me down the front of the class. I remember it very, very well. Very well. And I went home. I live very near the school. It was about 300 metres away from where I lived.
Right.
And just I think about it quite a lot now. I go back in my childhood quite a lot now and think about all the hardships that people went through here. Because we living in Australia, we live in heaven. It's absolutely fabulous, fabulous place. I never regret coming here. But when I reflect and think about our childhood, we had hard, hard times. Big families. Winter time comes along, ice on the ground or snow on the ground, whatever the case may be. You go out. I knew some of the kids in our street that lived in our street had no shoes, no stockings, and was walking around like that. I remember it well. Then we go up to a place
in the middle of winter.
In the middle of winter, it was absolutely dreadful.
And your house was it a tenement house?
No, my house was a four-roomed house. Two-story, and when I was younger, three families lived in it. My family lived in one room, and the other two rooms were taken up by lodgers.
Right.
So we had one room for a kitchen, another room for a bedroom, and the other two. And then when I was about...
Who was renting it out to lodgers?
The person that owned the house. Right. Yeah. The person that owned the house, and I remember well the actual cost of the rent. Because my mother, every now and again, it say to me, "Dear Eamon, a pound and sixpence. When the Jew woman comes, give her the money." Right. Because the Jew people owned it all those areas.
So the Jewish owned the houses and all the
rental properties around there. But and then for fun times we had a penny or a halfpenny or whatever the case may be, and we played toss school. We'd play toss school as little kids.
What's that?
Put it on the back of your hand, toss her up in the air, and you would try and win a halfpenny or a penny or a sweet off another kid, whatever the case may be. Right. That's the pastimes we had. I'm just getting a bit nervous now, and I'm going to slow down, and I'm just going to tell you.
Can I ask you then, how many, when you say the house, right, how many people living in your one room?
In my one room, there was my mother, father, and three kids at the time.
At that time.
At that time.
So you were the second eldest.
I was the second eldest, but a couple of kids had died beforehand because at the time, this was around the 60s in Dublin,
right,
which was very, very hard. When you were poor, you were poor.
Right, but you have considered yourselves poor.
We were poor, but rich in a way that we always had pants, we always had clothes because my father was a tailor.
Right.
And when you got a pair of shoes, the first thing your father would do would be send you up to the little hardware shop, and you'd buy a packet of studs, and he would put them in. Every house had an anvil. So he'd put the studs...
An anvil
for shoeing, that a cobbler uses. And he would put all the studs in that to stop you wearing down the sole.
The shoes, right.
And that helped quite a lot. But many, many, many times, in the houses that we lived in, everybody had lino. So there was lino on top of lino on top of lino on the floors.
Right.
So when you got a hole in your shoe, your parents hadn't got the money to send you down to the cobbler to get new soles or new heels on. So what you would do is you would pull up the corner of the lino and get the underneath piece and tear a piece off and put that inside your shoe. Then you go around. But it would never, you always walked around with your feet wet. Snotty nose and your feet wet.
Right.
Everybody, it happened to everybody. The one thing that I always think about too was the time that I brought Ursa, my wife, down to my house. And when we went into the house...
It's the same house now.
Just the same house.
So two rooms.
Two rooms.
Living room, bedroom.
Two rooms, living room, bedroom. And I brought Ursa down. And we were only in there about a half an hour. And she said to me, "Eamon, where's the toilet?" And I said, "The toilet? Oh, yeah." I said, "It's out in the backyard." She says, "Where?" And I said, "Come on, I'll show you." So we went out to the toilet. And at those times, everybody's toilet was always stuffed because of the fact that we'd no toilet paper. Everyone used newspaper or whatever was handy.
Right.
And because the newspaper didn't disintegrate when it went down the toilet into the sewage system, it blocked it back up, and it was always blocked. So I had to send her out to this toilet.
Oh,
and when she went down, she says, "Eamon, I can't use the toilet. It's blocked."
Oh,
but anyway, anyway, that was one of the another thing about the properties there was the properties had you never painted the inside or outside of your house. You never painted your house at all. All you'd done was for decoration. Coming up to Christmas time, your mother would send you out, your father would send you out up to the shop, the wallpaper shop, and buy wallpaper. Yeah. We'd wallpaper the walls. Now I remember in latter years, when I was about 12 or 13 years of age, my father said to me, Eamon, I need to wallpaper the house.
Right.
So will you come
and
down?
How many kids were around at that stage?
At that time, when I was, there was about eight or nine kids then.
Right.
There was a lot of kids. You know, my poor mother was pregnant all the time. But
what was the last year that she was pregnant?
To which?
Well, how old was she when she had her last child?
50. She was 58 when she had her last child.
58?
Yeah.
I know she had, how many kids in
she 20,
total?
She 22 births altogether.
22 births.
But
that doesn't include
the miscarriages.
No, that includes the miscarriages, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that includes the miscarriages.
I've obviously said 24.
Five, yeah.
She 22 kids. And but like, when
why 22 kids? Like, why do you think?
Well, don't forget, they had no televisions in those days. And another thing they had too, and I remember it well, every Sunday, my father would get a big bag of loose peas. These peas that you would steep, you know, mushy peas?
Yeah.
And he would start at the top of the stairs, and he'd throw them down the stairs, and all the peas would go everywhere. And he'd say to all the kids, okay, kids, go and pick them up, and he'd be gone for half an hour. We didn't know where he went.
Are you serious?
That's him joking now. Come on.
Are you serious? No.
But really,
are you serious?
He actually used to do that. For
so he was up. Oh my God, Roger and my grandmother.
But that was the way. Don't forget, there was. How are you going to get privacy in a house like that?
Yeah,
there's very, very little privacy.
How long are you going to convince kids to pick up peas?
You know what I mean. And I remember when Ursa stepped over the first time. Ursa stepped over. We happened to have to sleep in the bedroom that my mother and father slept in. There was two beds. And when we getting into the bed, I remember my sister saying to Ursula, when you get into bed, you have to turn to the wall. You can't look out. And we've laughed at that ever since, you know what I mean? We've laughed at that ever since.
So where did you meet Ursula?
Well, when I was, you know, kids like that, grown up in those times, you were street boys at 3 or 4. It was as simple as that. Like, at 3 or 4, you'd be out of your house, your mother wouldn't even think of looking for you until maybe dinner time would come in, or somebody would come in late, and someone would stand at our front door shouting the names, Eamon, Gerard, Sean, Tony, Brian, Emil, Callum, name, and call all the kids in. Oh yeah, and then call all the kids in.
Can you imagine doing that every night, 22,
in for tea.
Getting to your 22nd
for tea. Sounds like the fucking last supper. Peter, Paul, Mary.
And when we got a little bit older, your mother and father would be in bed and we wouldn't be coming until, 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night. Yeah. And your father would shout from upstairs, whoever was downstairs, Eamon, call out the kids, make sure they're all in. And they'd have to go, Eamon, yeah, and they all show, yeah, here, I'm in bed.
Really?
And that's the way we've done it, you know, to keep it.
Like a roll call.
So, explain to me then, how did they all sleep?
Well,
how many beds was there for the kids?
Let me tell you, there was two beds in each room. I slept in a bed where there were 6 kids in the bed. We never, ever, ever took all our clothes off because there was no lights in the house, for starters. It was gas lamps, mandals, you know, the gas lamps that you would have. Or the candle, bring up a candle and you put a candle somewhere on the wherever the case may be. And we'd all get into bed, slip off your shoes and get into bed. Because if you took your clothes off, you'd never find the same clothes again. Somebody else would wake up in the morning and be gone with your shirt or with you.
Really? But,
absolutely. But I remember when...
So they'd steal your shirt?
Well, they take your shirt. They take the nearest thing to them to be gone. They wouldn't even know they had it because it's dark.
Right.
There's no light anywhere. The only light we had was, there was no curtains on the bedroom window, was the light in the street.
Right.
And if the glimmer man, they used to call a guy a glimmer man, he'd come around on a bike every night, just before dusk.
Yeah.
And he had a long pole, and this is true, he'd have a long pole, he'd park his bike, take the pole out and flick the switch to light the mantle outside the house.
Right.
That's where we got our light from.
My God.
But, you know,
question was, where did everyone sleep?
Where did everybody sleep? So we had there was two beds in my mother's bedroom, and there was two beds in our bed, and they were double beds.
Right.
So there's six, maybe seven. Whoever sneak in, you sleep on top of each other now. And the thing about it too was, we'd only have maybe one blanket.
Yeah.
And a sheet wouldn't even exist. But you get your coats, whatever coats you've got, you get really? Them and put them over the bed. Well, so
you wouldn't have been cold then, because there was all body heat.
Oh, well, that would, but, you know, growing up like that, in hard times like that, you didn't really feel the cold.
Really?
You didn't feel the cold, you know, because you were going out in the cold, you hadn't got big jumpers and big gansies and big socks and everything else. You went out, the kids in my street went around their bare feet in the ice.
Because they were so used to it.
Yeah, they were so used to it. But the only problem is, when you have bare feet on ice, you slip a lot.
Right.
Yeah, it's very hard to stand up. You know what I mean? But I'm trying to think of one little incident. You know, we had a gramophone. Everybody had a gramophone, and we used to play. Put these little records on the gramophone. And I remember one that was constantly on all the time was "This Old House Is Afraid of Thunder." Do you ever remember that song?
No.
"This old house is afraid of thunder. This old house is afraid of cold. This old house sits in the rain." That particular one, and played on and on and on. And every time somebody came down, put on the record, put on the gramophone now, put the record on for them to entertain them. But another very, very, very funny thing. I tell everybody this story. When somebody died in the street, at that time, you could when you walk up and down the street, everybody had their window open because a lot of people had TB.
Tuberculosis.
Now, on reflection, I don't think this was happening at all. So they'd all have their windows open, and you'd have old people sitting at the windows in their beds, sitting up, and you'd always get a whiff of poverty. And that whip of staleness and everything else that comes out of tenement houses. And you know, one thing
just explain what a tenement house is.
A tenement house is a house maybe three or four stories high, and everybody would be renting a room. And a whole family would live in that room, and there'd be one toilet, and that'd be in the backyard. And it would be never, ever, ever cleaned. I'll tell you what the condition of the toilet was. The dirtiest toilet that you've ever been in your life, that's exactly what the regular toilet was in those days.
Right.
But who's going to clean it?
No sense of hygiene.
No, there's no. And the thing about it was, there's maybe 20 people living in the house, maybe 25 people living in the house, and a lot of them are kids. And what do kids do? You know, they go to the toilet, they just run off and do whatever they have to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's.
And was there flushers, like the chain flushers?
Yeah, they had a chain flushers that hardly ever worked. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The chain was broken or something was wrong. There was always something wrong. But
go back to the story.
Yeah.
You were walking along. You could smell the poverty.
You could actually
somebody
smell the poverty.
The street,
and it's something that never ever leaves you. I can even now. I can get to smell that poverty.
Yeah.
And people, instead of curing them, I used to think it would kill them. But I have to tell you what used to when somebody had died.
So what was curing them? Sitting in the window, getting fresh air.
Yeah, getting fresh air.
You thought it was killing them.
Yeah, well, no. At those days, I thought it was curing them. Now I think it was killing them.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
You know what I mean? Now, in reflection, I think, geez, hold on a minute. They shouldn't be doing that. That was the wrong way.
Right.
Or they take them out and they bring them up to the hospital and put them out on the verandas in the freezing cold.
Yeah.
Trying to cure TB.
Right, right.
And
I remember something about the tar on the road. The kids had held over the fumes of the tar on the road.
Consumption, you know, consumption they call it as well, you know. And your mother would bring you down to, we live beside the gas company. And the gas company used to have coke, and they would make coke, make tar, and make gas.
Mm-hmm.
And your mother or your father would bring you down, and they would hold you over the fumes to inhale the fumes of the gas, of the coke,
right,
to try and. And it was, instead of looking back on it now, it was killing you instead of doing anything else. You know what I mean? Jesus.
Okay, but, go back to the story. So I feel like I've got two Mitches trying to manage. I'm only joking.
But getting back to the street where all these people died. When a person died, everybody, all the kids would always look out. When you died, there was a little white card put on your front door. RIP, and the person inside is dead. So when we would see that, all the kids would go around saying, you know, oh, hey, lads, come on, quick, let's go. And we'd all queue up outside the house to go in and see the dead body. So we queue up outside the house, and the time had come to see the dead body. And inside all these places, especially in the poorer areas, there'd be a group of women in there, all the women in there, right. Everybody dressed in black with a candle burning. So, you know these ghost stories and ghost films that you see? So all of a sudden the door would open and the next kid would be grabbed in. So the door would open and somebody would put a hand out and grab you by the shirt or the collar and drag you into the room to go over and see the body.
Really?
And they'd pull you over to see the body, and as soon as that happened to you, you got this fright. And you were trying to get back, and you were trying to get back. No, no, no. And they'd be pushing. Come on, go on, go on, go on. And then when they get you over to the coffin, you'd look in at the body, and the body would have its hands folded with a set of rosary beads in it, and they'd grab your right or left hand, whichever was free, and put your hand onto their hand, and you'd be absolutely terrified. Think out of it, you'd never get. And then the next fella, and you do the same thing over and over again.
So you never learnt your lesson every single time.
And then another time you go to a funeral or a little thing like that, and somebody give you a cake. So they say, here, share that. And there'd be a queue about maybe 6 or 8 kids outside. Yeah. So you'd have a little bun, a little cake. So you give everyone a little bite as you're coming out. You're at the minute seeing the body. Now your turn, get a little bite. And they do the very same thing over and over again. And that's the way it was. Like, it was hard. But
can I ask a question? Like, you know, with having so many brothers and sisters, like, what was that like? Like, what was the good part about that? What was not good about that, do you think?
The good part about it was, because you'd have so many brothers and sisters and so many relations living around you, you felt very safe when you went to school.
Right.
Because when you went to school, everybody bullied you. And having a name like Behan, or Bean as they call them in those days, they used to jeer you or say something. And Bachelors was a great, great company at that time, Bachelors Beans. So what they would say was, hey, Bachelor Beans. And then there'd be a big fight, a big mill. But all the kids, because there were so many of us, they'd be afraid to say that to us. Right. You know what I mean? So we felt dead safe walking around. But other kids get bashed for their name. And everything else, you know what I mean? And that's the way kids.
So was alcohol a problem for families back then?
Alcohol was a great thing when you were a kid, because don't forget, the only little recreation that we had was this tough school that we would have. You get a bicycle wheel with a twirl on it and a stick, and you'd have races down the road with this. And then Friday night and Saturday night would come, which was great, because Friday night you went up to the local pub, which was only around the corner from us, went to the local pub, and you'd sit outside the local pub, a half a dozen kids waiting on the fights to start. So the men had come
waiting on the fights.
So the men had come out that night after having a few beers, get out on the road, and there was always a fight. So they get out on the road and they take off their, everyone wore braces.
Right.
They take off their braces down, open their shirt, they had a buttoned up shirt, that extra collar that you put on, and then they'd fight. Right. And they'd have to fight with their fists. If they used their legs around like this, all the kids would cheer them like mad. They'd never forget it. You know, dirty fighter and all this. And they'd stand there. And then afterwards, that'd last for about 4 or 5 minutes. Somebody else come along and say, stop this. And then they'd all be the best of pals forever. Until the next night. Until the next time they got a few beers on. But
so do you remember watching that?
Oh, without a doubt. There are things that plant in your mind. You never forget.
My God.
You never. I look at the two parts of life. My Australian life and my Irish life. My Irish life in the early stages were very, very hard. And they were very hard on the parents, because the parents were, it wasn't that you were living from day to day, it was survival all the time.
So was it the poverty, do you think?
Yeah,
that
it was
made
the poverty.
Hard?
They had nothing. What had they got? They had nothing. You went up the road, you got a head of cabbage. There was always a pot of potatoes in my house. We grew up on potatoes and porridge. A big pot of porridge in the morning.
So, go on.
I have to mention, my eldest sister, that I'm very close to now, is her job was very, very hard, because she used to help my mother with everything.
Right. That's Kathleen.
So
there was your brother, Jerry is first, then you, and then Kathleen.
Yeah,
is that right?
And then Kathleen. Kathleen came next, and Kathleen got all the jobs. And Kathleen used to have to wash the floor, wash that lino. And I always remember on our hands and knees, washing the lino in the kitchen, in this little kitchen that we had. She'd be down the hands and knees washing this, and the other kids would come in and walk all over it. And she'd be shouting, "Don't be walking on the floor till it dries." And then what we used to do, what she used to do was, the local newspaper, the Herald and the Mail, they would take sheets out of that and put them on the floor when she'd washed that part of it. So you wouldn't put your footmarks on it again. Yeah? But I remember one night, so everybody, at night time for entertainment, when your father came in from work, all the kids would come in, sit around the table, your father would bring in, your mother would have to send you up to get a quarter, and this is 100% true, a quarter of black and white pudding, more white than black.
Right.
So you had this little piece of black and white pudding, a little piece of black. And your father would come in, sit there, and your mother would take out the loaf of bread, cut a couple of chunks of bread, and your father would get the pudding, and he'd put it on little pieces and spread it like that, and hand it, everyone got a bite. And outside our house, and this is true as God, outside our house, all our friends, all our kids, would be standing outside waiting on a bite. So you bring out a cut of bread and you give everybody a bite.
Wow.
And if you hadn't got the black and white pudding to put on or the white pudding to spread on it, you get a bit of sugar, which was very, very scarce in those days, a bit of sugar and margarine, and you sprinkle it on it and you give them all a bite of that.
My God.
And that's the way those people lived.
My God.
You know.
So what do you reckon was the toughest part of having the 22 kids and the so many of the siblings in the family? So the good part is you got to feel safe. What do you think was the pain of that?
The pain of that, I didn't really feel pain until I turned about 10 or 11.
Yeah.
Then I was starting, in school you had one teacher through the whole of school.
Whole time.
You'd never had to change a teacher.
Yeah.
You had one teacher, and we were actually taught absolutely, on reflection, absolutely nothing. We were all stupid when we came out of school. We really were. And the majority of people that I've talked to since then, that I've been in school with, they were all self-educated afterwards. Mm-hmm. But because of the fact you were streetwise, they had a certain type of intelligence that they, when they got to a certain age, they looked for something.
Mm-hmm.
And one particular fellow in my class ended up the chairman of CIE.
Right, CIE was a bus company.
The big chorus emperor.
Like transfer. Yeah.
Another friend of mine who was in a class just below me became a professor of zoology in University College Dublin.
Right.
And they all got the same type of education that I got, and we all came out stupid.
Right.
Algebra, all those things, we hadn't got a clue what it was. If we'd done subtraction, addition, and multiplication, that's all we ever done. That's all we were ever taught.
Right.
But because we were all the way we were in life, we were able to grasp and educate ourselves then. Right. From then on, and that's what we've done.
So you started work at what age?
I started work, I got my first apprenticeship when I was 12. I was a foreman in manufacturing, if anybody ever sees this, manufacturing engineering company at 17 years of age.
Right.
So I was in charge of an engineering company at 17 years of age, which was very, very hard because all the people, the tradesmen, were all over middle-aged men,
right,
some of them,
right.
And it made it very hard on you. But I started work when I was 12. I went to went to Bolton Street Tech, got educated there. I got an apprenticeship, and that's how I knew what I knew. But the person that employed me, how I got employed was, I was leaving school, I got this certificate, a primary certificate, which I've showed you,
mm-hmm.
And I still have that certificate, I got this primary certificate, I put it in my pocket, I got on a bus, and I went down the road, the bus cost me tuppence or truppence, I might have snuck on, and got off at this place called Oxia Engineering. I went in there, into the tool room in there, and this guy came down the white coat, he said, what do you want, son? And I said, I'm looking for a job, and he looked down at me, he says, yeah, what? I said, I'm looking for a job. I said, I'm looking for a job. What age are you? He said, what age are you? I said, and I didn't, and I remember this well, I didn't tell him my age. I took out my certificate and showed him my certificate.
Right.
And I said, there's my certificate there. And I never told him my age.
Right.
And he said, you had a look at the certificate. And he said, you're looking for a job. Okay, he said, go in there to that lady there and give her your name, he said, and start on Monday.
Right.
And I started simply because I'd done that.
Right.
And I showed him that. And when I went in to give her all my particulars, she said to me, and the guy's name was Mr. Fitz. Does Mr. Fitz know you're only 12? I says, oh, I showed him my certificate. He says, oh, that's fine. Okay. And I started work there. And he took me under his wing. And it was in his... He left there and set up his own engineering shop. And then I started to work from there. And at 17, I remember it well. We made the first bridge, and I was in charge of it, roll-on, roll-off bridge for Rosslare Harbour.
For Rosslare Harbour.
For the cars, roll-on, roll-off.
Wow.
And we made that in a place called Seville Place in Dublin. And that's where we started. And it was, you know... Mm-hmm. And at that time, I was in love, I got married.
Ursa when you were about 16 or something?
I met Ursa when I was 12 years of age at a dance on a Sunday afternoon.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah, and I brought her down to my mother and father when we were 14 years of age. And she sat across the table with all the kids around for dinner. And it was because it was Sunday, the leavings of the Sunday dinner was called the secret weapon. So my father said to her, sit down there, love. I'm going to give you something now and put a plate in front of everybody and cooked up this cabbage and potatoes on the cooker.
Right.
At that time, we had you know those old black iron cookers?
Yeah.
Gas? One of those. Cooked up and put it down in front of him. Now, he said, eat all that, love. He said, eat all that, love, because you're very skinny. And she said, okay, oh yeah. She never, ever, ever forgot that. She remembers it to this day,
yeah.
the words that he used. And while he was talking, one of the kids said across to me, hey, Eamon, do you kiss your girlfriend? And my father went behind him, getting slapped in the back of the head. He still has that red mark about.
No, but speaking of John, he was very good to Ursula. Ursula had come from a very, very bad situation.
Yeah,
and he had taken her in and taken her under his wing. And I mean, Ursula speaks to me all the time, and you know, all through my life has said to me, you know, your granddad took me in like I was his own daughter, you know, and protected me and fed me and would, you know, take the food from his own plate and put it onto her plate so that she was, you know, she said it was the first time she was ever amongst the family where there was so many kids, but they were just, they all loved each other.
And there was fun and happiness and joy all the time. There yeah. was always crack going on. And regardless of what we made, like, we went out, we got old bits of timber and made sticks and sold them for a penny. And we'd bring them into your mother at the end of the day and give, because somebody had to pay for the bread, and you know what I mean?
Yeah,
somebody
yeah,
had
yeah.
to buy the loaf of bread and somebody had to buy the good thing.
Yeah.
Even though my father, believe it or not, was orphaned. My father was in Artane orphanage until the age of 15.
Was he? I didn't know that.
He learned to be a tailor there.
Wow.
When he was finished,
is
they
St. David's.
Yeah.
Artane, where I went to secondary.
That was an industrial school at that time.
Holy
they
shit.
They used to take in all the... My father was in the Artane Boys Band, played the flute.
No.
He did so in Crow Park.
Played the flute. I never knew that.
I swear to God.
He was orphaned out.
Yeah.
From what age?
From... their mother died when he was... there was 9 kids in their family. Their mother died when he was 5.
Wow.
And he went into the orphanage.
Wow. And how did he get out of the orphanage?
Well, they keep it up to the time you're 16. He got out at 15, and they sent him to, because he was a tailor, he was at a learner's trade, they sent him to a guy in Monaghan.
Right.
A family in Monaghan that were doing clothes alterations and all that type of thing. He stayed there for a year and a half, and they treated him pretty bad. They used him for just getting a couple of dollars, a couple of pound or whatever the case may be. So he left there and he got he came back to Dublin on his own. He hadn't got enough bus fare, so he walked most of the way from Monaghan to Dublin and came into O'Connell Street. And his first it's not his first experience, but his first experience of being free in O'Connell Street, he saw this tailor shop, Harrington's in Abbey Street. He went in there and your man gave him a job straight away.
Wow.
So within 6 months, he made him a partner.
Wow.
So he was a partner then only at a very young age. So then he decided he'd open a shop in Moore Street, which he did. And he had three people working for him. One of them was his brother, who lives in Adelaide, moved to Adelaide.
Right.
Paddy Behan. And his wife's name was Molly. And they moved eventually to Adelaide. And he had four people. But the problem was... The problem was that to make enough wages for that every week was always a struggle. It never worked out good, you know what I mean? But one of his specialities was invisible mending.
Right.
You know, invisible. And everybody had an overcoat in those days. Right. So what you do with an overcoat when it wore out? You didn't throw it away. You sent it back to him and he turns it inside out.
Right.
So he takes it all apart, cleans it all up, and sews it back up and turns it inside out.
Wow.
And that's what he done. And that used to cost 30 shillings, £1.50.
I remember I got in and I was making me Holy Communion.
Mm.
And I went in and my granddad was to make a soup. He used to make a soup for all the kids for their Holy Communion. That's my
dog.
That's
the dog.
That's my dog. Don't kick the dog out. Hayman loves dogs. No, but I'd go into the workshop. And I always remember my granddad, because my granddad always smelled the cigarettes.
Smoked camel cigarettes.
Remember that? Our roll-ups.
He'd have roll-ups, yeah.
And his lips were always pierced and his fingers were always yellow from holding needles.
Yeah.
And I remember I went down to get my to get measured up. And I go in with Ursula and I'm up the stairs. And I remember it's up the stairs and there was clothes everywhere. Piles of clothes. And he says, come in now. And I go in and he says, how are you, son? And I'm, good, granddad. How are you? Good. Now you have to get your pants off. I have to measure your pants. And he made me take my pants off. And then... And there's lots of people sitting around. And what does he do? He pushes me out in the middle of the floor because I was in my jocks. Just because he thought that was hilarious. And I'm like, Jesus, and I'm trying to hide behind the counter. And he's laughing his head off. He thought this was the funniest thing. And but he was just... he was just such a warm man. He was just such a warm man. He would constantly... make sure that you know he'd always give you a pound, he'd always sit in me, you know, sit in his knee, he'd always, you know, he was just always kind to me. And he was, you know, I only had a certain amount of time with him, but he was always just a lovely man, you know what I mean? It was just a level of kindness.
Well, I want to talk about that a little bit, because that's well and good, because you were one of three, right? Yeah. Three, you know. But how was it for you? Because you said there was fun and there was laughter and there was joy in the house. But how did that, like, with so many kids, it would have been hard for you guys to spend time, or was it, and was there affection, and was there that same connection that Mitch would have got from a grandfather perspective? Did you kind of get that from that, in a fatherly, like, from your dad? And I'm not trying to make that sound like you didn't get affection or anything. I'm saying, what was it like? Like, because it would have been, he would have been, and your mum would have been spread thin with quite so many kids. How did that play out?
Well, it played out in such a way, because I've had this discussion quite recently with somebody. And, you know, I love you are never, ever, ever came in from your
the
parents.
The words. Yeah.
Never, ever came in from your parents. But the affection was there, because the sharing was incredible, because we'd so little. So my father and mother were big sharers, no matter what they had. They were such good sharers that you just blended in into a situation, and you never felt that you were an outcast. You never felt that there was somebody special. You never felt that way.
Right. So it was through their actions and through the bringing together and the sharing you felt
exactly
all connected.
Exactly. Everyone was connected. Like, I remember very, very well, and a lot of Dublin people would know, there was pawn shops everywhere.
Pawn shops, yep.
Yeah. So when you come along and you make a communion, your mother would get the money from the diddly that you'd be at a collecting, and you go down and buy a pair of shoes.
So just so people understand, a diddly is when you make a communion, you're taking around from house to house, from family member to family member.
Yeah.
And the house you're taking to, they would give you money.
And then
were you guys making your communion every week?
Well, I just tell you how hard it was for people. So what you do was, my father would make a suit. for you because my father was a tailor. Yeah. So she didn't, not like the other kids wouldn't have a suit. Yeah. So we'd have a suit and we'd have a pair of shoes. So on Monday morning, three or four of our relations would come over to my mother's house. I remember it well. To borrow the shoes, one had borrowed the shoes, the others had borrowed the suit, the others had borrowed an overcoat was there. Anything that looked good, to go to the pawn shop, to put them in for the pawn and then take them out on Friday, on Saturday in the night, so you'd have them for going to Mass on Sunday morning.
Right.
And that's the way life was with so many people. I remember things were so bad with me. I was trying to get the rent and we were at the Buena house. Myself and I were at the Buena house. I was only 17 when we bought a house. And the house was £1,800. So anyway, we bought this house, three-story house, everything was going great, and I had to pay the mortgage, and I was short of the mortgage. How am I going to get the mortgage? Because in those days we smoked, in those days we had a pint, and the environment that I was in, because I was in charge of this workshop, you had to have a certain little bit of a status, bit of respect from the men, you know?
Right.
And the relaxation thing was you'd have a smoke or whatever the case may be. But the wages was very, very small. And I remember this Monday morning thinking, geez, where am I going to get? I have to get it. And taking my watch off and on a bicycle going down by Amin Street Station, going into the pawn shop and pawning my watch for £1.50.
So you can pay the mortgage?
To get the £1.50 to pay the mortgage to my next payday to come along and do it.
Did you get the watch back?
Oh, got the watch back eventually, but I had to because Ursa knew I had a watch and I couldn't get rid of it. Chief, where's the watch? I don't need it tonight, love. All right, everything's grand. But anyway, that's the way it was. But we had it. We were very, very blessed with the parents that we had. They were, but, you know, In those days, parents in those days got absolutely nothing out of life. Their big outing was down to Sandymount Strand or to get on a train. I have to tell you this quick story. So we had so many kids and so many relations that on when the weather would get fine, summertime, at Sunday the father would say, OK, tomorrow we're all going to Killiney. So how would you get to Killiney? No cars, we'd no cars. We're going to Killiney on the train. So we'd all meet at the train station, the Dardises, the Beans, all those people, and we'd meet at the train station, and the parents would be downstairs to the ticket office, and they get two tickets, one for the mammy and one for the daddy, and they take the kids. Okay, kids, you just go ahead. We'd all run up the stairs. Now there'd be about 10 or 15 of us run up the stairs, and the man would be waiting to check your tickets as you're going through the gate. We'd all run through the gate.
What's he going
to
do?
The man would be shouting, hey, come back here, you little bastard. Where's your tickets and all this, mate? We'd run to the gate and just get on the train and the train would come, that was it. And do the same thing. Yeah, we had.
So you mentioned the Dardises there. So your best friend, do you want to talk a little bit about your best mate?
My best friend from the time you were little, one of my cousins got polio. Right? He was only 4, and I remember his mother coming in and telling my mother that he had polio. He went to get up out of bed at night.
Was he around your age, Eamon?
Yeah,
or were
he was
you
around. He was 2 years older than me.
He was older than you. Yeah.
So he was 2 years older than me. So at 3 years of age, he got polio. So the facilities for people in that situation in Ireland was zilch. Let me tell you, zilch. So all of a sudden, his mother sent him, he got into Pierce Street School, that was all right. He was pushed around in a wheelchair, all that type of thing. The kids used to push around. And then his mother said, OK, I'm going to England. So his mother packed up the whole family and went to London. And the next time I saw Noel was 20 years of age. Mm-hmm. So Noel came back to Ireland, mm-hmm. and he came off the boat in a Henkel, you know the little Henkel's bubble cars?
Yeah.
In one of those.
Really?
That he was either getting free of the English government because he was handicapped.
Wow.
And he was taught as a diamond cutter.
That's right.
So Noel was a diamond cutter.
Right.
And Noel made a very, very, very good living and became very successful. And he made many. He was a big-hearted guy. He made many, many friends. Mm. And he was.
I remember having a conversation with him about God one day. I don't know how it was. I think I was 26 or something like that. And he was very unhappy. Because, you know, coming from a Catholic country, he was, you know, he felt he'd really been dealt, but he was such a good human.
Lovely fella.
Fuck, I mean, like, he charitable. Was really, 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 really loyal to you. And a, like, friendship like that, I've never witnessed anywhere else than how close the two of you actually
were. Yeah, we were great, great friends. And him and Mary, we used to play, before he married Mary, we used to play kiss chasing around the flats.
Right.
I'm chasing Mary up and down the stairs, trying to catch her and kiss her.
Now he's got polio.
Yeah, no, no, that was no. We'd be downstairs in the wheelchair. And Mary would be one of the girls that we'd be all chasing.
Right, right.
Then he'd all come back in. Then we'd all stand there. Okay, now, everybody, you all have to give Noel a kiss. Noel would be sitting there waiting on. Do you all come over? Do you all come over and give him a kiss? Give Noel a kiss.
That's
it was fun, fun, fun. And but even the people that, and the you know, the friends that we made in those days. Later on in life at Noel Dardis in Dublin, we still kept contact with them up to the time Noel Dardis died.
Wow.
When they'd go home, come home from here, we'd meet in those pubs, and those people would be still sitting in the same friggin' chair, sitting in the same place and over
so,
there.
So you guys were very social when I was a kid. You used to go out to a pub called Jack Ryan's.
All the time.
Every Friday night. And I remember hearing about this pub, Jack Ryan's, and I used to, in my mind, I'd have this, like, really grand pub, because these pubs were like, the pubs over there, like, their bars were just all mahogany, and they were, you know, they had these really really beautiful brass, and they were beautiful, like, because it was all about the pub.
Yep.
There was nowhere else to go. And I remember my dad telling me, oh, we're going out to Jack Ryan's, and the crack they'd be having, and like, and I remember at 16 years old me saying to my dad, Dad, take me to Jack Ryan's, I really want to go and see Jack Ryan's. Oh my God!
What was it like? A tiny little room.
When we went to the Jack Ryan's, Jack Ryan's was the toilet in Jack Ryan's had no roof on it, and it had growing out of there for the last 150 years, and weeds coming down the side of it and all, and the women would have to go in this door, and you had to get the key and go in, and Jesus, when you think about it now, you wouldn't put your hand on the doorknob, and you just go in, and the women would go in and go to the toilet, and there'd be nothing said about it at all, and the toilet was stinking, and the place itself, and
it was a hot pub, wasn't it?
It was alive, and it was fun. It was fun, and it was really, really, really. And you, like, I didn't drink at that time. I didn't drink. Mm. So Ursula liked a glass of wine, and we go down. We had our friends, and the people that we hung around with were really, really good. And you had a camaraderie thing. It was great, and you also looked forward to it. It was your highlight of the week.
Yeah,
go down to Jack Ryan's now on Saturday and Sunday night. Yeah. You know what I mean? Go down there and sit down and have fun and all of those.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I know that from what Mitch has said to me in his memories of childhood was how much you guys socialised. And one of the other things he used to always say was really about your friendship and how your friendship with Noel was very, very important to you, right?
Yeah.
Tell us, what's your most famous saying, Eamon? The most famous saying about friendship that you would say? You've said it to everybody. If you have
one good friend in your life, let me tell you, you're very, very blessed.
One good friend on your deathbed, right?
You have loads of. Let me tell you, I tell to the kids all the time. You meet acquaintances, and the kids come along and say, "Oh yeah, well, I'm not going there. I'm going out with my friend." They're all acquaintances. They will pass through life. In 5 years' time, you might know them.
Yeah.
But the friend that you make, you're gonna make forever, and the friend will do anything for you. And the most important friends in your whole life are your family. Never, if you fall out with your family, fall out with them for a day. We're human. We fall in and out all the time. It's a human thing. But make it up and sort it out, because at the end of the day, when you're lying on that bed, the only person that you have beside you is going to be your family.
Mm.
And that's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. So here's what we're going to do. Should we leave it there for the moment?
Yeah.
Because I think we've been chatting for a while, and then what we might do is come back and do part two. What do you reckon?
Sure. Yeah. Sounds great. Have you enjoyed it, Eamon, so far?
No, that was very, very good. There was some. To tell you the truth, no, but ending this message. Here now, I have to tell everybody, I'm 102, and my big thing in life is looking forward to being 103.